John Stowers and Hugo Vincent are here today. And just to give you a bit of background, during 2005, development began on Albatross, a completely new open source UAV project that's been surprisingly successful. This year, work has begun on a second version of the system consisting of a new hardware design, an overhauled control and inertial measurement system, new user interface software, and a custom designed aircraft. The two founders, Hugo and John, are here today to tell us all about it, and hopefully that will enlighten us to the stage maybe we'll become interested ourselves. They're master students at the University of Canterbury in Christchurch, New Zealand, where they both finished their Bachelor of Engineering degrees in Electrical and Computer Engineering with first class honours in 2005. And they presented a paper on more academic aspects of this project at the 12th Annual Electronics New Zealand Conference in 2005, winning the Best Student Award. So I'd like you to welcome John and Hugo and listen very carefully to their talk. It sounds interesting. Also, before we do that, if anybody has questions at the end, please make sure you get the microphone, otherwise they won't be recorded, so they won't, we won't be able to hear your voice on the recording or the DVD. Thank you.
Okay, good morning everyone. I think the introduction best captured where the project is at the moment, and that's a snowball. It's growing in scope and growing in size, and I think it's a good time to talk about it now as ever. So I'll start off with that, in mind. So my name is John Stowers and this is Hugo Vincent. We started this, as mentioned, in about 2005 for our final year engineering project at the University of Canterbury. What we wanted to do was implement an autopilot type system for a model aircraft, and we started it and we've grown since then, and now, as we'll explain, we've had to address a whole lot of new challenges which came up while developing the first version. So what is a UAV? UAV, or unpiloted aerial vehicle, is typically a plane which flies itself in the most simplest sense. That can be either a fixed wing aircraft, it can be a helicopter, it can be a quad rotor aircraft. That's really not important. It's more expressing that there is intelligence in the aircraft itself and it can fly itself. Typically what you see on the news as a UAV are generally remotely piloted, so a lot of what you see as a UAV, there's actually someone sitting down in a control room somewhere actually flying them remotely. So what a UAV is actually trying to put all of the smarts onto the computer system on the plane, and it'll fly itself more than being flown by an operator. So in this photograph here, we show what we used as our first UAV, which is just a model aircraft airframe, a typical remote control aircraft, 1.6 meter wingspan or something. There's a number of good reasons for choosing that sort of airframe there. You see it's called a trainer aircraft, which is quite slow flying, quite a high wing, which means to control, it's actually a relatively easy aircraft to control. From the physical perspective, it's quite, when you talk about control modes, which is the characteristics of the aircraft and how difficult it is to, control, so to use the word again, the control modes of that aircraft are actually quite slow, so that has effects on how much computational power you need to control it. So you see a lot of UAVs just start off using a model aircraft airframe like that. Then once you have your control actually working, you can start to move on to a more difficult aircraft, which is sort of what we're going to be talking about. Actually, since then, that was we haven't actually used that aircraft in about the last 4 or 5 months because we've actually outgrown that. We probably were a bit short-sighted and chose too small an airframe, and it was just too much effort to try and squish everything in. Yes, actually, that's one other thing. We managed to get on Television New Zealand, which was quite fun. But we'll just actually show that video because it's a good bird's eye view of what a UAV is and where it can be used for and that sort of thing. So, on this, or hopefully this one.
Yeah.
and the students think it's got big commercial potential.
It looks like a normal radio-controlled plane, but the brain power of this flying machine is Kiwi ingenuity at its best.
Well, we have three axes of gyros, which are these here. If the plane dips one wing, then it'll be sensed through this gyro through the computer system, and the plane can correct.
The Kiwi-made electronics use GPS and air pressure sensors to fly the plane unmanned along a pre-programmed route. With cameras and other sensors on board, the designers believe it has huge commercial possibilities.
Forestry surveillance, greenery, wineries, farming, which is already done in Australia. They do some surveillance there.
It could also be used for real estate, surveying and border control monitoring, if they can get it running smoothly.
You
got it? Yep. Hang on. Problem? So we're just going to reboot it and see if there's any messages getting pumped out, like error messages or anything.
A few checks and adjustments and they're up and away again. Plane was the final project of their electrical engineering degrees. With more development, everything should be much smaller and importantly cheaper than traditional aerial photography methods like helicopters and light planes.
You can run and do a hand launch, and once it's in the air, it should be able to control itself, take photos based upon a path you've laid out.
In the months ahead, the lads will be working on the second generation of software and a new airframe to attempt the flight across the Tasman midway through next year. Blair Norton, One News.
Well, close up to long at 7 o'clock with a...
That was somewhat stealing our thunder with the Trans-Tasman thing, but we'll come back to that. since then, like I say, snowballed, and you know, I think this year is very optimistic. So.
The other point to note there, I guess, is being a TV station, they deliberately blur the boundary between what we have done and what we're hoping to do.
It's easy to make things look a lot better than they are on TV, I think. But so what we're going to actually talk about today is sort of what we're doing with these sort of plans and the requirements that brings up. What we learned from the first time we had to do real-time-ish embedded Linux, and how, you know, specific hardware considerations and also the perhaps the new and interesting thing, which has been the change in scope, is looking at designing aircraft and how open source tools can be used to help do that. And then, of course, some speculation about the future and, I mean, commercial aspects of this, or philanthropic aspects of how can these be used in, you know, developing nations and new nations and for good. Instead of for military, which is pretty much every other use of UAV at the moment. This is the basic architecture of controlling anything. I mean, in this case, it's controlling an aircraft, but the same is applied to, you saw the Segway dude maybe floating around yesterday. There's unpiloted underwater vehicles. It's a similar idea. You start with, initially, a control algorithm in a control loop. It's so-called a closed loop, where in this case, control is just making the plane stable in its own space. There's no intelligence above, just say, holding its heading or holding its altitude. It's stability in one.
A regulation process.
Yeah, regulation is a good word. So you have a control algorithm which is maintaining stability of the aircraft, driving some output of the aircraft. In this case, you know, you have your control surfaces. You are measuring that through inertial sensors and through GPS, which we'll talk about. And then perhaps the difficulty or the little bit different thing with an aircraft is estimating a state, because there's a few specific considerations when you're actually flying and just the nature of the plane being in the air and you being on the ground. You have to be able to convert between the two reference points. Frames of reference, yeah. So that's a consideration which is specific to a plane and will not... but challenging in a plane. And then above that loop, which just provides you control and stability, you have a navigation algorithm, which from the perspective of the television and interview like that, I mean, that's all the cool part. That's the, like, you know, follow a GPS route and fly around. But really, that's the icing on the cake. A lot of the work and a lot of the theoretical stuff is in the control loop at a lot lower level.
And by comparison, the navigation algorithm's quite easy.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely... a lot more can be just taken from other sort of projects and very similar concepts, but the difficulty of the real-timeness doesn't come in until the control loop, which is more closer to the hardware.
So So I'll just elaborate a little bit more about the sensors, because these are really the guts of our system. The main sensor, I guess, is the GPS receiver. Now, you all know what a GPS is. Basically, what we get from that is position in 3D. So we get latitude and longitude, and also altitude. What that can give us reliably is orientation of what way we're pointed. With an aircraft, with a fixed-wing aircraft, I should say, you can get a vague estimate of heading or yaw, basically by looking at the difference between points. But if there's a crosswind or something, that won't be very accurate. So the challenge becomes, how do we measure the orientation? And that's the most important parameter from a control point of view. You can't have a stable flight without, you know, knowing which way you hit it. If you look at a pilot, you know, human pilot flying an aircraft, they're looking at the horizon constantly. If they can't see the horizon due to clouds or whatever, then they've got a virtual horizon. That's basically what we're doing here. We're giving the computer a virtual horizon. But measuring orientation is not easy. There's no direct way to measure it that's anywhere near affordable. So what you have to do is kind of guess, basically, what the orientation is based on a few references. So we can use the Earth's magnetic field as a reference, much like a compass does, and we can also use the gravity vector. So we know gravity goes down, so if we measure acceleration going down, then it's down. But it's not quite that simple either. So basically, to measure the gravity vector, we use three axes of accelerometers.
Do you want me to?
Yep. Okay. Yep. So this is our hardware. It's quite hard to see, actually. Right. So in the bottom right there, that's the sensitive segment of the board. And John will point out the accelerometers, which are what they use to measure the gravity vector, so that measures where down is, basically. So there's actually four of them, because they come in two per package. So we only need three of them, one for each axis, X, Y, and Z. And as well as that, the problem with measuring gravity via acceleration is, if the aircraft's moving, it's got an acceleration of its own. So that gets added onto the gravity vector, and the acceleration you measure is no longer necessarily downwards. So in addition to the accelerometers, we have gyroscopes, which are these things here. And what they do is measure rate of change, rotational rate of change, basically. And because of the way the physics and these sort of devices work, can you go back a slide, sorry? You can't measure the actual... The rotation as an angle, you can only measure its rate of change. And what that basically means is you're measuring the derivative, so you have to integrate it, which presents problems all the time. So, as you might remember from high school calculus, or I'm sure a lot of you have done higher calculus and stuff than that, integrating stuff is fine if it's a perfect signal, but of course it's not. It's got noise, it's got drift, it's cheap, which pretty much leads to those previous 2 points. If you can spend $50,000 on a gyro, you can get a good one that you don't need to worry about, but our ones are about $40, and they're not so good. So you can't just blindly integrate, because if you do, you'll suddenly measure yourself as spinning around on the spot at hundreds of degrees per second. It'll have no correlation with where you actually are headed. The other challenge is the frame of reference thing that John talked about before, and basically that means you're measuring the orientation with respect to where, you know, the sensors are in the aircraft, so you don't necessarily know where they are in reference to the surface of the Earth, which is what's useful, because that's what you don't want to crash into. And you can convert between the various frames of reference, so you can convert between measuring in the body frame, is what it's called, so the sensors on the aircraft body and the Earth fixed plane. But they're quite expensive conversions in CPU time, so you either have to put in a big whopping CPU or try and be clever about it.
Just for example, GPS immediately measures in the Earth frame.
Yeah.
For example, that's the first split, the GPS is in the Earth frame and everything inertial is in the body frame.
Yeah. So you have to do that conversion no matter what. But And the other problems we get is, as I mentioned, noise. There's also vibration from the engine. So you have to filter the outputs from all these things, because otherwise you're not seeing the motion of the plane, you're seeing the motion of the vibration of the engine, which isn't very useful. Then you also have to consider the trade-off of sampling rate, so how fast do you read information from those. You know, you have to consider how fast the aircraft itself can actually move, and you know, higher frequency components of what you're measuring are just going to be rubbish from vibration and stuff like that. And the trade-off there is, you know, the faster you sample, the more information you get, but a lot of it's rubbish, and it costs you a lot of CPU time to filter that out. And if you sample really slow, then you don't get the information as fast, so it may take longer to correct, and the aircraft won't behave as stably, and it won't be as smooth flying. And then you know, with all of these problems, you have to also trust that they actually work, and you have to know that at any point in time when you actually fly the thing, that you'll be able to get it down safely without it crashing into the ground, like on the video.
And this is a limiting factor here, is our limited source of money. I'm sure we might be more keen to try more ridiculous things if we had more planes and more hardware. But
and we were students at the time, and in fact still are, so we don't have a lot of money. Well, all of these problems we've mentioned basically leads to a requirement of quite a lot of CPU time. And so what we've used, funnily enough, being at LCA, is an embedded Linux system. And unfortunately, we couldn't fit a big ATX mainboard or anything on our plane, so we've built a full custom board. Are we going to switch the video? Yeah. So we're basically just going to talk you through what the hardware is, what it looks like, what it does. So the big section down the middle is a separate circuit board that sits on top of the main one, and that contains the CPU and stuff, and that actually is an off-the-shelf component. That has a PXA255 processor, which is the same as a lot of Palm Pilots and cell phones and those sort of things have. And we've got 64 meg RAM, bit of flash, Ethernet, USB host, those sort of things. So we've got most of what a normal PC has, except slow. And we'll talk about that again in a little bit. The PXA is quite a limited processor. So besides the CPU or the processing section, we've got the sensors, which we showed you before, over to the bottom right there. We also have pressure sensors, which basically are used to measure the altitude, you know, like a barometric altimeter, like on a plane or whatever. We have the GPS unit, which is on the back there. And we have a few other bits and pieces. We have a power supply, which is, well, spread around actually, mostly there. We have a radio for communicating with the ground. We would have liked to use a Wi-Fi radio, it would have made things a lot simpler, but the range just isn't good enough, unfortunately. So we're using a serial data modem, so we get about 56 kilobit each way, but it had a few problems, which we'll talk about again in a little bit. It's just on the industrial spectrum, so no license here. I think it technically may be just over the power limit, what's legal. So.
And also, we kind of ordered the wrong one, so we're technically illegal in New Zealand.
We ordered the right one, and then they sent us one that didn't work, and we got it. We sent it back under warranty, and they sent us a different one that wasn't legal in New Zealand. But we'll just keep it quiet. So other things that we've designed into this board but not necessarily used yet is we've got things like temperature sensors. We've got another pressure sensor for connecting to what's called a pitot tube, which is used to measure airspeed. We have some thermocouple inputs for measuring things like engine temperature.
Yes. Generic input.
Yeah. And we have a bunch of debug connectors and stuff. So that red connector on the top there basically hooks to another little board. Have you got that there? It's in the box. And that's got things like serial ports on it and debug ports like JTAG, if you guys know what that is. It's a standard for debugging interfaces. And we've also got an Ethernet port, which was quite a significant part of how we developed, and we'll talk about that again in a little bit. I think that's all we need to show on the hardware. So there it is, slightly better picture. So, like I said, started with a commercial single-board computer, built a mainboard for that to sit into, and added all the sensors and GPS and radio and all that sort of stuff around it. And It's a four-layer PCB that we have made in Australia. It's all hand-soldered surface mount, which was quite painful. and we kind of over-designed aspects of it because we were paranoid that if we didn't build in enough interfaces and so on for debugging, then we wouldn't be able to get it to work, and we couldn't afford to spin the board again if it didn't work.
It was a bit of a one-shot game trying to get it to come up first time and everything for our requirements of our project. The other thing is the choice of the single board computer was also determined by Hugo actually worked at a company.
Yeah. I worked for the company that make that board, so they gave it to us for free.
Yeah.
Which... the company is Blue Water Systems. I did throw that name out there. It's in Christchurch, New Zealand, and they do ARM consulting, much like the Sage guy who was here the other day. It sounds like that's the same sort of deal. So now I'll hand back to John, and we'll talk a bit about software.
Okay, so in the block diagram at the start, there's the control and the navigation loop, navigation challenges. So our first attempt at the software, we sort of split that down into five independent daemons running and communicating through a UDP multicast framework. And we thought that was a great idea at the time because we could also develop really, really fast. I mean, I could be working on the navigation and Hugo could be working on the hardware interface bit, and we could chop and change between running it on desktop PC and on the host. And, I mean, we plug in a network cable and everything appears the same.
Yeah, so all the software is written in C. It all runs on embedded Linux, obviously. So there's five processes. Each of those programs is a separate process in Linux, and each of them has three threads. So quite a lot of overhead there just from the scheduling, which we'll talk about again in a bit.
So we had those communicating over a network-based communication IPC framework and that we wrote ourselves for, I don't know why, actually. But to be honest.
Seemed like a good idea at the time.
Yeah, there's lots of good ideas at the time. We also then had some software running on the ground, which practically it was more for debugging and for pretty pictures. So we've had, like, you can see there, the glass cockpit, which is based upon OpenGC, which is an open source glass cockpit programming thing, so quite similar to people. I actually saw a photo. Sorry?
Pretty.
It is pretty. I actually saw... Raytheon released a remotely piloted vehicle thing and their big screenshot, they're running OpenGC, and I was like, well, it's pretty impressive.
On 324-inch LCD.
Yeah. So lots of people, there's a lot of really, really niche, really, really well-done flight simulator-type software in Linux already.
Unfortunately, OpenGC changed their license a little while ago. They used to be GPL, and now they're not, and so Raytheon didn't release any of the codes that they did.
So like I say, there's these five daemons. Hardware is... communicating with the hardware, or optionally can be swapped out, like I say, for simulation services. Communications is routing stuff over the radio, because the consequence of implementing our own IPC thing, we had to translate stuff to our radio, which was not a Wi-Fi device, which is why we say the Wi-Fi probably would have been easier to start with.
Yeah, so what that does is it receives packets off the onboard network and queues them up and sends them out through the serial, through the radio.
And then there's the control loop, which is, which is... what I said, which is what I said about keeping the plane stable in the air. So you have to keep it stable within its axes of control. So you've got a pitch and a roll and a yaw axis, and then you've got other loops for altitude and for airspeed. But primarily the pitch, the orientation control, which is the pitch and roll and the yaw, is the...
If you can do that, you can stay in the air.
Yeah. That's the first milestone. Yeah, if you can do that, you can just fly in a straight line indefinitely, sort of thing. So when we were thinking about this, and this was coming back to our limited time and our limited money, we really, one of the important things that we chose early on was to design to test, and how can we make this work having only one spin of hardware and one airframe and some limited time. So this governed in our choice of architecture with the multiple daemons. We could swap things out and we could run things in simulation mode, and it was transparent from the perspective of the plane. There's also the other side of that is, you know, you can almost replace the plane entirely and do a complete simulation, which is a lot more important for the Trans-Tasman thing, because that's more of a long time frame that we want to be able to simulate, and that's at the navigation level, simulating at the navigation level as well as the control level. And we really, unfortunately, wrote our own framework to make this needed, but we did get a lot of stuff for free. I mean, we can... It's not every day you can, you know, develop something on a desktop PC and chuck it on an embedded device that'll work. And I mean, you get all of this networking stuff for free, and it's really, really quite easy. So
that's why embedded Linux is nice, because you can do that.
Yeah.
You get the network stuff all there, and everything works. Hmm.
So that made it possible, really, for us to do it in about 5 months or so. But like I say, we made a lot of concessions, and we probably made some wrong decisions. So yeah, like I say, at first thought, multicast UDP is quite good. Medium independent is the key. It would have been more medium independent if we had used a Wi-Fi radio, and then it would have been completely transparent. But we thought, you know, we don't want to deal with synchronicity. We want to make the smarts at above those five daemons of doing control and hardware and stuff. There is an overriding controlling daemon which decides where the plane goes. We wanted to do.
Do you want to explain why we want asynchronous?
Yes. Do you want to explain why we
Well,
do you explain why synchronous is bad later?
Well, when you have multiple processes, I mean, we're dealing with a real-time control system. So we get data from the sensors, we do something to it, and we send data out to the servos which control the plane. So if you're in multiple processes, you have to either communicate between them synchronously and make sure all the data gets there reliably, you know, a TCP type approach, make sure it gets there in the right order. But the problem with that is you can get unwanted latency, you know, if all of these five processes, you know, if the 1 in 1,000 type scheduling events on Linux where it doesn't schedule them properly, then you might start using one sample old data rather than the current data. So the asynchronous means that you can only ever see the latest data because the old data's gone.
We didn't want to sort of deal with the problem of having to assure that things were coming in the right order, and we didn't want to deal with that at the time because we had limited time, so we thought, well, we'll just design everything to start with to be asynchronous, and we'll throw away old data and we'll use the latest, and we'll put the smarts a bit higher up and take it out of the kernel. Maybe that was a good idea, maybe that was a bad idea. But like I say, the pros of that immediately is that we overwrite the oldest data, so it's never really stale unless it stops receiving, which is the main trouble there. And also it's not very deterministic, so we're not really sure when something gets lost or it fails really, really ungracefully. You either take a long time to notice or you don't really notice at all, and recovery is quite hard because we're basing our estimate, it's like a rolling estimate, so we're always estimating, and when something drops out, you either notice it becoming less accurate as an estimate, and you're like, oh, why is it doing this? Is it because there's a hardware problem, or is it because we're actually getting towards the ground? So
ideally, it'd be able to smooth out of those little glitches, but not really.
So that's just more of this is actually the split of daemons that we had. So we had debugging, hardware, reading stuff, controlling servos, state, which is the control and the making stuff from the body frame to the to the ground frame.
All the maths, basically.
All the maths, yeah. And future work above that is navigation and stuff, but that sort of relies on everything else being working.
This is kind of an old diagram as well.
Yeah. Oh. Is that easy to go? And we saw this, you know, we thought at the time it would be easy to do things asynchronously and manage loss of data ourselves, and, you know, we thought that would be a good idea, a good use of our time. And then it turned out that, well, we were doing five processes and we were doing three threads per process to read from hardware, and we actually ended up having a ridiculous amount of overhead for what we thought would be a cleaner way to solve the problem.
Too much CPU time in the kernel and on our code.
Yeah, it was spending too much time between threads and doing things that we could do better. So this is our new approach, is we're actually just going back to a single binary with a single main loop. We're doing everything synchronously or as close to as we can. And then if it turns out we need to really be concerned about a difference in samples of, you know, 10 or 5 to 10% between each time we sample it, we can just do that in the math. We can correct for not fixed sample rates in the math instead of having to architect our whole system around making it easy to do. And so to get the whole abstraction that we got last time using multiple daemons, we're just actually we're rewriting it in C++, and we're just using a more object-oriented approach, and we're separating things out that way, and at the protocol level rather than at the daemon level sort of thing.
So we use things like, you know, inheritance to get around the, are we running in a simulator or on actual hardware type difference?
And at the, so we can have a single daemon, and we can just get a lot, we're using like the flight gear, for example, the flight gear binary protocol, and we're sort of using some stuff that's already existing, and doing it at that level, doing our abstraction at that level, which makes a lot more sense because we get a lot more control over, and we know when things have been missed, and we know because we're doing a single loop, which is deterministic, we know when we miss a sample and things like that, and we can correct for that. Whereas before, we had to wait for the kernel to tell us, and then we'll wait for it to fail.
Yeah, so just in case any of you don't know, FlightGear is an open source flight simulator, and it's a massive project, and it's really amazing. I don't know if there's any FlightGear developers here. Anyone?
Cool. Yeah, well
done. We'll talk to you afterwards. Congratulations. So that's one of the sort of development ideas we've had. So designing for testability and making sure things will, you know, making sure you're confident it's going to work before you launch it and risk wasting all this money. So the other one is designed for rapid development, which we've also talked about. So this is, we had 5 months to do it. We had really limited money. So we try and architect things so that not only can we test them easily, but we can also develop them easily and quickly. So the main sort of general overall thing we do for this is, as we've talked about, simulation. So we use FlightGear. We previously used another simulator called CRC Sim, which is quite primitive, but it does work. So simulation's nice because you can develop everything on a PC. You know, the CPU is much faster, things compile and run much faster, and you can check things work with a proper debugger and all the sort of nice development tools that everyone spent decades developing. For developing on hardware, for testing stuff, we basically made use of embedded Linux again. So we've got this Ethernet port on the hardware, so we basically just plug it into a network, and we're using a bootloader called U-Boot. So that pretty much does what a BIOS would do on a PC, and it's set up to actually boot off the network, so it fetches the kernel off the server on the network, and it mounts an NFS file system over the network, and so we can have the same file system on a PC and on the hardware, so we can compile a new kernel, 30 seconds later we can be running it without any kind of flashing or anything like that, flashing of hardware. So that was one aspect. I guess the next one is the tool chain. So one of the main things we needed to be able to do was for our code to run on PC and on our hardware. So we use GCC, obviously, and we set up a cross-compilation toolchain, and we use a bunch of macros and stuff in the code to do anything that needs to be different between x86 and ARM, which is what that is. So I'll talk a little bit more about the toolchain in a bit, because there's quite a few difficulties with GCC on embedded systems, which we do eventually get around. Accessing hardware. Now, Linux lets you do this in a couple of ways, obviously. You can write a driver and set it in the kernel and access it through the various interfaces the kernel has for that. Or you can do it the dirty cheek way, which is what we did, and basically just open up /dev/mem and directly access the hardware from user space, which means everything has to run it as root, and it's quite dirty, really. But
do you want to say everything goes through the FPGA?
Yeah, we'll switch back to the hardware. So on the CPU board, which way around are we going?
Yep.
So that thing is the CPU, that's the PXA255, which is an ARM processor. And there's RAM above it, those two black chips above it are 64 meg of RAM. And to the left, the big black chip is an FPGA. How many people know what an FPGA is?
Sorry. Yes.
That would be a long explanation. So all the hardware, all the sensors and so on, all go through the FPGA. So the FPGA is memory mapped. It looks like memory to the PXA. And we run code in there that basically just reads all the data from the hardware and sets it in registers that you can just read like a memory address. So in the software, you just open up /dev/mem, and mem map the relevant piece of memory and directly access the registers.
All of our real-time hardware reading from the IMU inertial sensors and stuff is actually done by the FPGA. There's code running in there as well.
So there's a little state machine on there that actually, does all the machinery, all the sort of mechanism that needs to be done to read stuff from sensors, you know, like requesting the data, waiting for it to be processed, reading it back in and getting it there so that the CPU doesn't have to wait around. And so this rapid development thing, it takes its toll. In the picture here, you can see the plane without its wings, with a bunch of insulation tape, with the battery taped to the wheel, and held together with paper towels. And there's basically a bunch of circuit boards sitting in there, just to see how much vibration messes things up, basically. And And we got debug information coming out over our Ethernet cable, which is not in the photo, and also over the radio. Yeah, I mean, if you put the battery on the center of mass, that's sweet. The plane we're using can lift, you know, 5 kg easy.
That battery was actually stowed inside when it had its wings on and stuff.
It's only taped to the wheel because it's sitting on the ground, and it's got no wing anyway, so it's not really flying anywhere. So also back on the hardware, I've already showed you that, so we've got those debug harnesses, we've got Ethernet, we've got all the various things. And the final thing is, we've already mentioned we did it all in C, the first time in the C++, so. I'm doing the slides there. So that hardware, it works, it's good. We did it in 5 months, which was kind of cool. It is not perfect by a long stretch. The PXA255, that ARM processor we're using, it's got no floating point unit. And this is quite a big deal for us. All the maths is done in floating point. You can emulate floating point on an integer processor, but it's slow. And this comes back to GCC. The way GCC and embedded Linux on ARM typically work, like out of the box, is the compiler emits instructions that don't exist on the hardware. So there's assembly level instructions for floating point, and the CPU doesn't know what to do with them, so there's an interrupt pin or an undefined instruction trap, and then it goes into the kernel, and the kernel runs some code to emulate what that instruction would do if the silicon was there to do it. So every time you have, you know, an add or a multiply, you've got to switch into the kernel, you've got to run some code in there, and you've got to switch back to your process. And that costs about 1,000 cycles or something, which is ridiculous. We could do it in one if we had a floating point unit. We thought about writing our own in the FPGA, and it kind of almost worked, but the bandwidth was bad and it wasn't ideal. So basically, I guess what I'm getting at is, if you're going to build one of these, for God's sake, choose a processor with an FPU, because it's just not worth it. You can, and that's what we did. So rather than switching to the kernel, what you can tell it to do is, instead of emitting that undefined instruction, you can make it emit a little function call that does that emulation of the floating point in the same process, and that only costs about 40 cycles. But even still, you know, the processor is only 400 meg. 40 cycles is still quite a lot. You know, what's that effectively make it a 10 megahertz processor? So.
And we're trying to control it 20 times a second, the core routines anyway.
Yeah. Other problems was, like we mentioned, all the analog data is sampled through the FPGA, and the FPGA is kind of asynchronous with the processor, so when you read data, you don't know exactly when it was sampled, you know. You don't know if it was one sample ago or two, or so 1.5 ago. It's quite crude, and that is fine from a software point of view, but it makes the maths really messy, if not impossible, and basically just means things don't work when they should. Other problems was, because we use this off the shelf single board computer, there's a lot of stuff on there we don't need. You know, we don't need an audio chip. We don't really need USB hosts. I think there's some other stuff on there as well.
MMC, arguably.
There's a memory card slot on there as well, which we don't need. The power supply we've used is complicated. You know, we were paranoid, like we said, and wanted everything to work reliably, so the power supply is grossly over-engineered and really complex. And the whole thing, you know, it's not that big, but for a plane it is quite big, and it's quite heavy, and it's quite bulky, and it doesn't need to be like that. So,
what was it?
How heavy, with the box and stuff, it's about 200 grand. That includes the antennas and all the various bits and pieces, except for the battery. So it's not too bad, but we think we can do it in about 40 or 50, so, which leads to the new version of the hardware.
Okay, well, the most annoying thing we found, or I think the most annoying thing, was having to do all of our I.O. through the FPGA, which is the most annoying thing ever. I mean, we had to maintain code for the FPGA, and we had to... There was no rapid development in the funnel sense that you get with embedded Linux with the FPGA on there. It was a very slow process to compile and test things and burn them. So that was very unideal. And Hugo mentioned briefly really hitting memory bandwidth limits, trying to read stuff over the memory bus from the PXA to the FPGA. I mean, what is it, 40 cycles it costs?
Yeah.
To get one word of data read from the FPGA.
Yeah. So yeah. 4 byte, 40 cycles. Mm. It should be one cycle.
So we think, you know, that's not a smart solution. But again, we didn't design the SBC. That we got given it for free, and it worked at the time. But in hindsight, we're choosing a PXA with an integrated, you know, hardware controller to do reading from the ADCs on SPI or on ITC or its own hardware bus, and it'll do all the difficult stuff more for us. The other main deal with what we've changed is, like Hugo said, is we're taking out a lot of what's unneeded. We hope to get to about, like you said, 30 grams.
Yeah, and about one-third the size, about the size of a single board computer in the middle.
A lot of that, and by choosing our own PXA and stuff, that simplifies the power supply requirements, because a lot of the power supply we needed was for the FPGA on that. The other thing is, just for more practically trying to fly the aircraft, abstracting out the aircraft specific things. So we're going to talk about a little bit. We're doing mixture control and stuff to get better efficiency of the engine. So we're abstracting that out into its own board and getting that off the main CPU board, which is going to be almost just a floating point SBC with the inertial sensors on it. Yeah. Essentially, yeah, and it'll be physically separate.
It's doing real-time minimization of fuel flow, so it's got sensors to sort of estimate fuel flow and try and minimize it by leaning out the engine.
Essentially this is sort of what we're designing at the moment, but we got a little bit sidetracked by the software side of things with simulation and stuff. But the idea is to do a very long endurance flight from Australia to New Zealand, because it's a prevailing wind, and yeah, it should be between 30 and 35 hours. And this sort of drove the need, well, we need our own airframe. We need to address the challenge of space there. And that's sort of what we're spending our time on at the moment.
Satellite radios are kind of heavy, so we're using the Argos satellite, which is designed for tracking animals and stuff like that. And transmitters for that only weigh about 10 grams. Yeah, including the antenna and the battery, which is fantastic. Yeah,
really, really low data rate, but you know, once it's been known to fly stably over land, it should scale to flying, you know, 20 hours, 30 hours, 40 hours.
Providing should be.
Yeah. Sorry.
What size?
Hugo's going to talk about the airframe now. Yeah.
That's good. We're dealing with a custom airframe design. This is not the sort of thing you can buy. It has kind of been done before. In 2001, a group flew a similar-sized aircraft across the Atlantic from North Canada to Ireland, which is about the same distance, and that was a world record at the time. And I think the Trans-Tasman route's about 100K longer than that, so we'll... So the main requirements of an aircraft like this is it's only allowed to weigh 5 kg. And this is a legal requirement, otherwise you have to stop in customs and stuff like that, which could be tricky.
By legal requirement, also somewhat of a loophole.
Yeah, I guess.
Under 5 kg is...
5 kg makes it a toy plane, as opposed to any kind of military thing or a drug smuggling device or anything like that. Absolutely, yeah. It's not worth the risk. Yes, so 2.5 kg dry, 2.5 kg of fuel. So that's what's needed. So the picture here kind of looks backwards. It actually flies upwards. So the propeller's at the back. There's a big, long, thin wing. There's basically a tail surface at the front, and that's called a canard configuration. And that configuration was chosen because when you're burning half the weight of the aircraft in fuel, the centre of mass, it has to stay in the same place. Otherwise, the efficiency, you know, you have to trim the aircraft as the centre of mass changes, and the efficiency just drops, you know, shockingly. So we need to keep the fuel tank on the centre of mass. So what we do basically is the centre of mass has to be where the centre of lift is. So we have, you know, a wing at the back and then one up at the front effectively. So the centre of mass is kind of about here. Most of the mass is the engine at the back. So the fuel tank sits there on the centre of mass, and you can burn all the fuel without changing the trim, in theory. So it is kind of an unusual configuration. It's all built from carbon fibre, polystyrene, and mylar film, and a bit of balsa wood as well.
Not without precedent, like canard's not a new thing.
No, it's been done before, but not at this size, really. Next slide. So besides the airframe, which looks kind of crazy just to get the efficiency of the drag right down, the main requirement and the hardest part of this attempt is the engine. Now, no one really works on really small engines and tries to build them efficient, because people who work on engines pretty much want to put them in cars, and cars care about efficiency, and core aircraft don't. So we're using a model aircraft engine, 9cc, which is 0.53 cubic inch, so it's a sort of standard size that's used on model aircraft. It needs to be small, light, cheap, and reliable, and you know the saying is you only get to choose two or three or whatever those, which we need all four.
Atlantic flight, how many did they lose before they got across?
Yeah, they built about 40 planes in all over about 20 years.
Yeah.
But they were trying to do a lot of other things as well, and of course the electronics in those days were rubbish. Even in 2001, you know, the electronics were pretty primitive. They had an 8-bit micro and only one gyro and a GPS receiver.
Yeah. Actually, circumnavigating the South Island is a longer distance than Australian engine anyway, so there'll be a lot of build-ups using that sort of thing.
So we can do fun things like change the mixture and flight and stuff like that, but I think it's time to wind up, so I'll just hand back to John.
Yeah, and the final thing that I wanted to say about when I say snowball is that, yeah, to do this and to be confident of our airframe, we really wanted to be certain and we wanted to be able to simulate it, and we wanted to try and use free software to do that. So there's a phenomenally cool program called AVL, Athena Vortis Latus, I think it stands for, which is a CFD, Computational Fluid Dynamics simulation package, written in Fortran by a guy at MIT about, you know, 10 years ago. And that'll do airframe simulation and
airfoil as well.
And so we can really start with an approximate airframe design, simulate it. That'll spit out a lot of parameters which we need to know to do the control. And then we also, once we've got that sort of cycle working, we can then also simulate the entire flight. So we can do that using flight gear and that'll look pretty. Or we can do it using JSBSim directly, which is one of the simulation engines of flight gear. And then we can do faster than real-time simulation. And flight gear is good to visualize. There's a visualizer as well for our particular application, but practically we can get the same thing using JSBSim directly. So we want to be able to have this cool iterative design loop of we can change the length of the wings, and we can do some airframe simulation, then we can do some flight simulation, and we can do some design. And we're going to come out with a working airframe at the end. Okay.
Sorry about that. Unfortunately, I'll have to catch up with John and Hugo a little while later, but I'm sure they'll be around for a while. And thank you.
Feel free to come and have a look at our hardware.